Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Barbara Peters at the Poison Pen in Scottsdale, Arizona. Well, actually, I lie. I'm Barbara Peters. I'm in my office in Scottsdale, Arizona. And it's our pleasure this afternoon to talk to Lisa Unger, who is somewhere in her office or home, for Last Girl Ghosted. And our co-conspirator is Karen Slaughter, who always has a great background. Where are you at the moment, Karen?
Atlanta. This is my purpose-built Zoom background because I was like, I got to up my game. I can't just have my bulletin board back there.
It looks amazing. You know,
I need to clean out this entire row of romance paperbacks that I have had probably for 40 years, thinking one day I would reread them and put something really great up there. But
I only like this one author. I don't read anybody else. Like all the languages, I read her. Yeah.
I love it. So we are talking about Lisa's wonderful new book, which published last Tuesday. And I'm happy to say that Lisa was kind enough once again to sign copies for us, which we have at the bookstore. So you're welcome to order one. In fact, we encourage you to order one. It'd be a really good idea. So you must have had a great week, Lisa. I mean, you've been doing this now for what, 5 days?
Yeah, I have. It's been great. I actually had 2 live in-person events here in Florida, which was, you know, I was telling Karen yesterday on the phone that it was unexpectedly just joyful. You know, I just felt so happy to be, you know, on stage. I spoke with Colette Bancroft, who's the book critic here at the Tampa Bay Times, and we spoke at Tombolo Books together, and it just felt like, I don't know, it just felt like really special to have everybody there. And I've been all over the country virtually this week. So it's been great.
Oh, it's wonderful that you got a chance to do something live. We've done a couple of small live events, but it's too hot to go outside and really too hot to open the doors. Yeah. And the store is not, you know, not gigantic. So this coming week, we have the biography of Tony Hillerman, and we're going to have a small crowd for that because that'll be really fun. I can't work out where we're going in this winter, but we've always done video and live together. So we'll just keep that up. If one of you comes out live, great. And if not, we'll carry on.
Yeah, I think it's a nice feature now. I hope moving forward that, you know, we can continue to do like these hybrid events. Both of my live events were streamed, one on Facebook and one on Instagram. And I think it's just a really nice thing for people who, you know, have come to rely on this, you know, people that can't get out of the house for whatever reason. This is like a real gift to them. And so I hope it continues even as we move more towards live events again.
Well, it's fun, but the other thing is we can bring people together where it would be financially, not feasible. I was telling Karen that thanks to Karen, who arranged for us to have a conversation with Ursa Secret's daughter, Karen and I, we are now doing an event with the First Lady of Iceland, who turns out to be a friend of Ursa. And it never would have happened if Karen hadn't suggested the idea. And you know, let's be real. What were the odds ever that the First Lady of Iceland and Ursa were going to come to Scottsdale to do a book event?
I mean, well, you never know. It depends on the time of year, Barbara.
that's true, Karen. February, we might have brought it up, but
that's right.
Really. I mean, there are just lots of opportunities, I think, you know, to put things together this way. But you're right, to have a live event, and you know, there's a magic to that. So I'm glad you got to have that experience. Yeah. It's wonderful. So Last Girl Ghosted, you know, I'm so old that my vocabulary is stalled. And I admit that I actually had to look up ghosted. What does this mean? I say to myself. So for anybody else who is behind the times, Lisa, because you're really kind of on the cutting edge here of modern social media terminology, tell us what your title really means.
So ghosted is sort of this thing that once upon a time, it meant something else altogether. Once upon a time, it was like a form of identity theft, right? When you took somebody else's identity, somebody that who died, and you slipped into that new person's skin, so to speak. And it was a lot easier to do once upon a time when there was no, you know, digital trail to follow. Of course, now that's a different thing. Today, it sort of means like when you've been involved with somebody or you've had a situationship, as the kids call it these days, you've been seeing somebody and all of a sudden they disappear from your life and all contact is cut off, you know, no phone calls, no texts answered, et cetera. You know, maybe their social media profiles, you get blocked. So that's what it means to be ghosted these days.
Wow, that's an upgrade from dumped, which was so rude. But of course, dumped was not nearly across so many platforms because so many platforms did not exist. You know, yes. I mean, it was basically telephone, letter, or in person, and that was about it. So I think what was interesting that you brought out for me was the enormous range of way that you can ghost people.
Yeah, or hurt somebody.
Thanks to new technology.
Yeah, I mean, the seed for the novel came from this conversation that I was having with a really young friend of mine. Of course, you know, I've been married for 21 years. So when I first started dating, there were no dating apps. You know, there weren't even smartphones or apps at all. You know, the online dating had just kind of started. And then, you know, so my friend was talking about how, you know, she's on these apps and she says, you know, there's just this endless pool of people and you can just keep swiping and swiping and swiping. It's the next one and the next one. And she was like, how can I ever know if I've chosen the right one? And then if somebody shows up in your life and they're just, you know, not what you expected from what you saw online, then it's just very easy to ghost that person or to be ghosted. And mainly that has to do with what you're saying. Like the pool is so gigantic, the scale, you know, the people that you could meet are around the globe and there's no immediate tie. There's no external reason to treat each other well. And that was sort of, you know, impressed me as being really sort of sad, you know, even though like technology has expanded the pool, it's kind of rewritten the code of how we meet each other. And it just seemed sort of broken to me. You know, just that this primal, like sort of ancient quest for like a mate, you know, is suddenly become almost, you know, soulless in a way. And so it was that sort of, you know, that feeling, that idea that was the seed for Last Girl Ghosted.
So Karen, you've been in a relationship all the time I've known you. So are the whole dating app just as foreign to you as it is to me?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Alifair Burke met her husband on a dating app. So, but when I first heard about it, I was like, oh man, if only I was a serial killer, because this is perfect.
Exactly.
It's kind of like, because years ago, Lisa and her husband would go and stay in strangers' houses in like Poland or Czechoslovakia. And I'm like, you are crazy.
Yeah, you really
one, two, that. You're sleeping in other people's juices. Three, they're gonna come back and kill you. Right? I mean, that's where my mind goes is murder. But I think in some ways it's really good for women because it's opened up opportunities for them to just hook up if they want to and then move on to the next one. And it's given them sort of like a sexual freedom that, you know, Lisa and I certainly never had. Barbara, I can't speak for you. I know you were a bit bohemian. But
that's very true. We didn't call it hooking up. We called it sleeping around, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, there was like a negative connotation to it. And I don't think younger women have that. And part of the reason is because of apps.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a lot more there. It's like almost a reverse process now where in my extensive research about online dating, there's something called a sex interview. Whereas, you know, sort of once upon a time, you might get to know somebody and then decide if you want to sleep with them. But now it's a little bit reverse. Like you may just meet up with somebody, hook up with somebody to have sex with them, and then decide whether you want to get to know them better after that. And so, I mean, you know, I guess it depends on how you look at it. It might be empowering if that's what you want. But if you're looking for something deeper, if you're looking for something more meaningful, and I think probably most people at their core eventually are looking for that, you know, that sort of deep friendship that becomes our, you know, our partner, then I think it can be a little daunting and a little bit overwhelming and maybe even a little bit, you know, sad sometimes.
Well, don't you think it takes the pressure off? Like, 'cause at work, for instance, a lot of men have thought, oh, I can only date women I work with because it's easier, and it's made it a little predatory in a way. But, you know, for women, they can just be like, nope, nope, nope.
Right. You know, but on the other side, I mean, but it's not just as if men have, it's not just as if women have access to those apps. Men are doing kind of the same thing.
Yeah, but there's a reason why it's free for women on some apps and men have to pay. <'cause> women.
Oh, yeah. I love you so much. I guess I become an 81-year-old widow.
Okay. That's right. Yeah, I will help you do your DTF profile, Barbara.
Well, you know, but that's what I was thinking about, because the truth, you know, the truth is there doesn't need to be any truth in these profiles. I mean, there's a possibility that people are vetted, but at the same time, I've had this discussion over the years that Arizona is a place where there are very few people native to it. And so Phoenix has had this enormous growth, and it's all people from someplace else. And as a result, they can make up whatever background they want. And, you know, this has been like the new field for private investigators, right? Because you can't just assume that whatever story somebody that you meet, whether it's at a cocktail party or a, you know, business get together or an app or whatever, you don't have any idea if the story that they present themselves as occupying is true.
Right.
So, you know,
that word catfishing, but there's another word as well called kitten fishing, which Karen would love. And it's, you know, when it's not quite a lie, you're not saying, hey, I'm a, you know, 20-year-old swimsuit model from Miami, when in fact you're, you know, a 40-year-old man in Tacoma. But you sort of curate the version of yourself that you're putting out there, little white lies, you know, half truths, you know, your picture is 5 years ago, you know, when you were 10 pounds or 15 pounds lighter or whatever. And that's like sort of this way that people have of like maybe putting forward what they think is the best version of themselves. But then eventually there has to be that real world meeting. And I guess you can hope that your charm and high energy vibration is going to make up for it. But depending upon, you know, depending upon how dishonest you've been, probably not.
Well, curated, you know, that's a really big thing. I mean, if you've been reading all the Facebook stuff about that, there was a big thing, I think it was in the Journal or the Times today, about teenage girls and how ruinous, you know, it has been for teenage girls on Instagram, because they're just trying to get to terms with the changes in their body. I mean, I don't remember, you know, I don't know how you guys felt, but I remember, you know, when I started growing breasts and things, and I thought, what's happening here, you know, and how am I going to feel about that? And so all these curated lives on Instagram showing the very best version of yourself can have a really negative effect on people who are struggling with self-image and identity and so forth. And
yes,
you know, for every advance that we might make technologically, isn't it astonishing the fallout on the dark side?
Absolutely. And it's definitely something that I touched on in Confessions on the 745 with social media. And, you know, certainly it's a big feature of Last Girl Ghosted. It's like how technology is rewriting the way that we communicate about ourselves, what we say to the world about ourselves, how we relate to each other. And that, you know, it's not, you know, we all know that our real lives are the it's what happens between those beautifully filtered and cropped, you know, Instagram posts. And if you don't know that, then you find yourself comparing your very messy three-dimensional life to the very perfect two-dimensional images you see on your screen. And for a young girl who's just sort of trying to find her way in the world, this can be, you know, just simply toxic.
Do you know what I hate about it? Karen's found a solution to this. Karen's much smarter than I am because she takes times out. Actually, I'm smarter than everybody because I don't even do any social media. The only social media I have is at the bookstore, but I don't belong to any social media. I don't want to do that. But it seems to me the most relentless part of it is that it is relentless. It's 24/7. You can't really get away from it. I mean, Karen, you can go off to your cabin and write, you know, and take a time out. When you do that, do you turn off, you know, your phone with this omnipresent device we all stuck with?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you can schedule stuff to post on Facebook, and it, you know, it's my job to find kittens every Saturday to post on Catterday. And, you know, I'm always speaking truth to meower, and just finding like the best cat. So like I schedule those, and then I'll say to myself, okay, I'm going to check in at this time. You know, I do it at different times because, you know, like Lisa, we are published in different countries. So you don't want to like let stuff sit in Italy and you're only paying attention to Flanders or whatever, you know. So I pick different times and I just put it in my schedule to check and make sure things are going well. What I won't do is TikTok because, you know, it's constant stuff that you have to put on. Otherwise, people don't watch it. And it's really hard to be that clever constantly and also write a book. So I don't want to shoot my wad on TikTok and have like a really great TikTok. And then suddenly I can't write a book. So that, I mean, it's like, because yeah. Lisa, you and I have talked about social media before.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to do something, you've got to really do it. You know, you can't just get an Instagram account and never post anything because people will be very disappointed. So I've been really careful about what I'm doing. And I mostly play around on Facebook, but I've been doing more Instagram stuff. Lisa, I know you've been wetting your feet a little bit more in that.
Yeah. I think especially since the pandemic, I think we've all kind of pivoted online. We sort of had to. And I think it's important, you know, to really compartmentalize the work that, you know, your creative work away from, you know, the work of social media. Mm-hmm. There's a book that was kind of a game changer for me. It's called Deep Work by Cal Newport. And he talks about the importance of batching work, you know, and his idea is that, you know, you have your creative self, you know, and that is, you know, the most important thing, the most important feature of your work, your deep work. And then you have the sort of shallow work of social media, you know, business, email, all that stuff. And that those two brains, they don't play well together. You know, like you can't toggle back and forth between the creative self and the marketing self. Like it's not possible. You're going to have a terrible drag on your creativity, and you're going to find that it's harder and harder to be creative. So for me, it's very important. You know, my golden, you know, creative hours are from 5 a.m. to noon. Those are really important hours to me, especially when I'm really in the heart of a book and, you know, nearing the end of it. And then during that time, there can't be any social media. There can't be anything like that. But when I do turn my attention to social media, I try to keep it as authentic as possible. Like I want it to be me, you know, I want it to be as close to my voice as I can. I want to be as organic in a very inorganic arena. I want it to be as true to who I am as it can be. And so, you know, I always think of Twitter as almost like a photo album. Like that's where Instagram is kind of like a photo album. It's where I'm my most creative. You know, Facebook is where I have my biggest group. And so they get, you know, and so I always see it sort of like as a house party. It's like, that's where people can come and like hang out with you a little bit. And then Twitter is like a cocktail party that you go to and you kind of, you know, connect with this person or that person, put the stuff out there. But it's, you know, I try to, you know, compartmentalize that work from the work of being a writer, which is, you know, got to be 95% of it.
But also no offense, Barbara, because I know that you dabble on the publishing side, but like something comes along and you see all these TikTok people talking about books and bookstagrammers and your publisher's like, you need to be on TikTok. You need to be on. And it's like, no, these people, when they are making time to do this, they're very genuine about it. And, you know, as much bullshit as online, people can tell when you're just like doing something because you're trying to market to them. Mm-hmm. And I've never wanted to do that. I mean, otherwise I would not show so many pictures of my cats, right?
Well, I'm with you. That's why there's so many dogs. Yeah, that's why I put the puppies up, you know, to make it more, which has absolutely nothing to do with the poison pen, other than I find them endlessly amusing. But that's really not what I was talking about. What I was talking about is that you can't really, you know, if you're having a relationship that's breaking, or if there's something personal terrible in your life,
right,
people expect you, you know, to respond to text, or they expect you to email or something. You can't. You feel weird if you go out without your phone, you know? I mean, if I drive down to the store and I don't have my phone with me, I feel sort of half naked or something, even
though there's that moment like, oh my God, I left my phone, you know?
I do that all the time though.
At a time, you know, like
that 24 hour access that I think is very toxic to relationships. And, you know, that is sort of where I was going. I mean, social media, you can schedule, you can put it aside and all, but what do you do, you know, if it's your kids or your husband or your mother, or, you know, you have a friend or something, and people think you have 24-hour access. So, you know, I've got a timeout feature on the phone, you know, just like 10 o'clock at night, you know, if the house burns down, if the store burns down or something, I'm just not going to know,
right,
because I've already turned it off. I can't do that. So right. When you're writing this particular book, tell us about, you know, tell us about Ren. We might talk about
the book. We're going to talk about the book.
Well, I want to know, Lisa, did you go on these dating apps? Because I felt like this is really clever, because I know Lisa's not on these dating apps to have a character who's not on dating apps. So you kind of, like, if you make a mistake, it's the character's mistake.
Well, I made my own app. I made my own dating app for the book, Torch. So I have my own rules. And, you know, no, I did not go on dating apps. I wanted to, but I asked Jeff and he said no.
I'm going to sign you up tomorrow. You tell him that.
Yes. So I am. So I'll just tell you a little bit about about Ren. You know, she's an advice columnist, and she comes from trauma. She comes from a dark past, but she's built a life for herself. She's, you know, through the things that have unfolded in her life, she has built a place in the world that is safe for her. You know, she has a family of friends. She has a successful career as an advice columnist, and she has a podcast, a very successful podcast, in a home that she loves. But her best friend, Jax, kind of pushes her sort of into the world of online dating. And she hasn't really been with anybody. She's been kind of cocooned in this life. She spends most of her time focused on other people's problems and not very much focused on herself. And so she goes into the dating world and she meets a couple of guys and she has these sort of underwhelming encounters. And then she meets Adam. And when she falls for him, she falls very, very hard. And they have this kind of whirlwind romance. And then after a particularly special evening, he makes a request. He says, "Tell me something that you have never told anyone." And she does. And then the next day, Adam is gone. He has disappeared. And his social media profiles have been deleted. His phone has stopped working. And the place where she thought he lived was just a vacation rental. And Ren is devastated. She is gutted. He's like the first person that she's ever shared herself with. You know, she carries deep trauma and shame, and she sort of handed it over to this person and he left her. And when a private detective shows up, she learns that there are other women who also thought they were in love with Adam, and that all of those women have disappeared. And so I guess instead of, you know, like most people might just sort of curl up and recover and move on, you know, and just be grateful that whatever happened to these other women didn't happen to her for whatever reason. But Ren is not that person. You know, she's a fighter and she's a hunter. And so she goes looking for Adam, and she wants to follow his very dark digital trail into his past and into her own. And that's
all you can say.
That's all you need. I can't say another thing about it, unfortunately. So you have to read it. So she was a very interesting character. And I did create my own, you know, of course I did all my research about online dating and, you know, all the sort of colorful lexicon that surrounds it. But I did create my own app called Torch, because I wanted my own rules. So I hope everybody loves it. I hope you read it and hope you love it. And here it is.
I wonder if they do like a dating app that does background checks, like legitimate police background checks.
Well, I think that wouldn't be such a bad idea, right? I mean, like a vetted, like sort of high-end dating app, right?
Where
people are curated and they're actually like, you know, people behind the scenes that like, I don't know, like psychologists and, you know, whatever else trying to decide, you know, trying to figure out who is okay, who is not okay, what is a good way to match people up, you know? Right.
Who has herpes?
Right. I mean,
Did you talk to a PI? Have you ever talked to a PI? Because I really like this character, Bailey.
He's sort of my, you know, Bailey Kirk is somebody who I guess is probably an approximation of a lot of different people that I've talked to over the years. I have a few retired FBI agents that I talk to a lot. And, you know, I just sort of, again, it's really, for me, it's about the person, it's about the character. So Bailey was, you know, I enjoyed him. I enjoyed getting to know him.
Well, yeah. It seemed to me that a professional investigator would be called for. She really wants to, you know, I mean, people really have that kind of skill set. I mean, it's all very well to say you want to follow him down his dark digital trail, but, you know, how do you do that? It's not Hansel and Gretel scattering breadcrumbs, you know, on the way to the witch's house.
Exactly. Well,
weirdly, when you say digital trail, I think of like cut off fingers, like digits. Yeah.
Real digits, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how easy is it for somebody to make up a whole new life today? I mean, you know, with the pandemic and with more and more online registration, you know, I just got a notice, for example, that my global reentry program, which is now called the Trusted Traveler something, that it expires in December and I need to renew it. Even if I'm not traveling, I'm going to do that. But you have to come up with all kinds of documentation. I mean, if you ever tried to get a visa to go to Russia, you have to go back and, you know, who was your fourth grade teacher, for heaven's sake? You know, people hardly even have records like that. So, you know, is it possible for an untrained person to acquire that information? Or, Karen, it's a great idea. What if you set up an app in which, in fact, a person would have to go through a sort of TSA process in order to even get on the app?
Background check. Yeah. I mean, it is harder and it's harder and harder to disappear. I mean, that's just the truth of it. I mean, there's literally a grid of cameras and there's facial recognition software. And if anybody's looking for you, it's very hard to disappear. But at the same time, it's not exactly a crime to walk away from your life. You know, people do it all the time, and probably more people walk away from their lives than are taken from their lives. But online, you know, there are actually people, and I discovered that there are people that will sort of create a new identity for you on social media and on the internet. And there are like actual fixers that people who will come in, it's like, say you've had some kind of a terrible scandal and you're trying to move away from that scandal. There are people that will come in and they can't get rid of what's on there, but it can slowly get buried by placing new information. And with search engine optimization and all of that, you can sort of get these new things to kind of pop up higher and higher. So the things that you're trying to get away from get buried deeper and deeper on your, you know, whenever anybody sort of Googles your name. So there are all different kinds of things like this. And there are people who, you know, there's probably the biggest reason people try to disappear is, you know, because of insurance fraud. They do something that's called pseudocide. Like they fake their own death. And there are ways to get away, but it really does involve, you know, sort of cutting all your digital ties and all your ties to every single person that you've ever known. And yeah, right.
But there's a difference between doing it online and doing it in real life too. It's much easier online. But also what you're talking about, Lisa, I mean, like the one thing that I'm always very disappointed about private investigators is they don't break the law and do all the cool stuff that they do on TV.
Right.
You know, so a lot of them are like, well, that is illegal in the state of Georgia. And I'm like, but could you do it? No. Right. So, and a lot of times, like a PI, they can run very superficial background checks.
Right.
Legally, police officers aren't supposed to run background checks on anybody unless there's like a valid reason for them to do it. Like, you know, the guy at Starbucks pisses them off. So there are all kinds of barriers to doing very deep dives. But, you know, if you get their social security number, you're kind of golden.
Right, exactly. And there's all different ways to, you know, to triangulate what you find on social media, who's following you, who are your friends, you know, where do your friends go? You know, there's all these different, you know, there's all this sort of, you know, tons of information out there for anybody that is looking for somebody.
Yeah.
And
you tell on yourself.
You do. I mean, we've all given our privacy away, you know, 100%. And I think that that's just sort of an interesting feature of our, you know, our modern existence. And it becomes easier, you know, all the time because people are, you know, the research I'm doing right now is for the DNA testing. And so, yeah. And so it's very interesting. There are these sort of forensic, they call themselves DNA detectives. And they recently were just sort of blocked by the law. But what they were doing was they were taking DNA evidence from cold cases and they were submitting the evidence to, you know, sort of the 23andMe, Ancestry.com, you know, companies that are out there, and they were getting back information. It wouldn't have been information about the person whose sample they had, but it might turn up a whole slew of relatives and give an entirely new lead to their cases. And so there were a couple of, there was just an article in the New York Times about this a little while ago. They were having some success with cold cases because it would give them a whole new group of people to talk to about this person or whatever the sample was. And you could say, oh, this is this by how the percentage of DNA they share. This is a brother. This is a sibling. This is a cousin. This could be a parent. And, but they were literally just blocked recently from doing that. Like it's unconstitutional. So
I agree with that because yeah. In a lot of cases it's like, well, there's five brothers and the police follow all of them and take very, like they'll pick up their trash and take very personal information, surveil them. I think there should be like a few more steps you have to go through to do that. Cause it was very scattershot. On the other hand, you know, the Golden Gate Killer was, or what is it? Golden State Killer was caught through familial DNA.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, it is a bit tricky because you think, you know, you a lot of stuff can come out that you don't want to come out and the police have access to that information. Like if you're I have a kind of like a criming family. And my sister and I were going to do that DNA thing for my dad. And we're like, do we want to like snitch on some of them? Yeah. Cause they're bad people, but you know, it was a real conversation.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, what if they're wrong? What if they get there and suddenly, hey, Lisa Unger, who's never met like the killer's family or anything like that, is somehow you come up and your life is over.
And what I find the most interesting about the DNA stuff is that, you know, a lot of people just are starting to say that, you know, it's not as infallible as originally thought, that there's, you know, there's a lot of questions about the evidence and what it actually means. And I think what's also really interesting about it is that even if you yourself have not submitted your sample, because so many people now have submitted their samples, you know, your connection is out there. Like at some point, you know, the dots connect back to you, even if you have never submitted your own sample.
Yeah. That's and like that's, a Fourth Amendment right.
Yeah. And this is just another example of how technology is sort of like rewrite society, right? Like, you know, this was like, it was 1986 when it really started becoming, you know, more readily available. I mean, it's not that long ago. And it's just another example of the way, you know, technology is rewriting how we relate to each other, how we connect, you know, how we live.
Well, and let's make it really clear that by a large amount, it's always going to negatively impact Black and Brown people. I mean, it just does. Mm-hmm. Because assumptions get made, and you know, there's no way to blindly go into that kind of test.
Right, exactly.
So I'm glad they're putting guardrails on it. I think they should put more. We give the police the power to take away our freedom, you know? Mm-hmm. So there should be some kind of, you know, hey, you got to talk to a judge. You got to do this before
there has to be a
something
warrant.
Like that's taken. That's yeah.
Right. Exactly.
So as crime writers, do you find that, you know, how you're approaching your stories, how you're thinking about, you know, what story to tell and so forth is getting shaped more and more by the available technology? I mean, certainly Last Girl Ghosted is not a book you could have written 30 years ago, Lisa. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, I personally have been diving pretty deep into technology and how it affects us for the last couple of books, because it's something that really fascinates me, is how, you know, the way we relate to each other is ancient. You know, our brains have evolved not at all, you know, over the last 100 years, but technology has evolved. I couldn't even come up with a number, 100-fold, you know, 200-fold. And so, you know, we still have this very ancient way that we need to connect with each other. We need to love each other. We need to, you know, we need to be together in groups. We need to, you know, we need to be known. We need to be seen. And it's a very ancient drive. And somehow, you know, technology, whether it's on purpose, we've purposely been manipulated by technology, which is certainly true, or whether it's just awakened within us or watered negative seeds within us to, you know, to just sort of hurt each other or connect in any way, or, you know, all of this, you know, all these different layers of how we relate to each other. So it's something for me that has been kind of an ongoing obsession, but also like sort of within, you know, just so many things fascinate me, like, you know, how texting has, you know, changed language, like changed how we communicate with each other. Like Karen and Alfair and I are always joking about like our emoji communication. Like we have said, we can communicate with each other just simply by sending emojis, right? But only because we know each other so well, right? Like I don't think you can use technology to replace relationships, but it can definitely augment your relationships and how you relate.
One thing, Lisa, that's universal, I think, that you've always been interested in and you speak quite evocatively about is trauma. And mm-hmm. this book has a lot of childhood trauma. Is that giving away too much?
No, definitely not. No.
So like, you know, what's that? I think that as writers, we write about stuff we want to know more about.
Absolutely.
And is like what we're going through, you've got a girl who's a teenager. And the pandemic has completely reshaped her life in a lot of ways. I mean, are you just thinking about the trauma of the pandemic when you were writing this, or just trauma in general?
I've always been fascinated by the human psyche, and trauma is just a big feature of that for many of us. And, you know, a lot of people who are formed in trauma, you know, they find their way forward in different ways. You know, some people don't come forward from trauma. Some people, you know, turn to crime, or, you know, there's mental illness that results from that, or addiction, and other people sort of white knuckle their way into the light. And that's always been my fascination. It's not necessarily the traumatic event itself, it's how we move forward after the worst thing happens. And that's kind of where that is the topic that I think you might find at the heart of most of my books. And the research for that, you know, I mean, I have trauma from my past, but, you know, the research into that is a continuum. And it's sort of like, you know, you talk to a lot of psychiatrists or psychologists, and a lot of them have turned to that work, you know, because of their trauma and their own past, trying to understand themselves, trying to heal. And I think that I have done that as well. Like, it's the place, the books are the place where I really examine all the questions that I have about people and about human nature and what makes us who we are. Like, these are the questions that continuously fascinate me. Like, what makes one person a criminal? What makes another person a hero? You know, what makes somebody who is a hero have a deep flaw that could ruin him? You know, like, these are the questions that I ask over and over again in different, you know, through different people in different books. So trauma really is at the core of a lot of the work.
Do you read Dickens?
I have, yes.
Yeah, there's a lot in so much of what you're saying you can find in the work of Dickens. I think maybe more than any other of the Victorian writers, and Trollope does some of it. And, you know, there's the Russians and so forth. But I always think, you know, Dickens does a whole lot of that nature versus nurture thing. Oliver Twist, you know, why do some children thrive and other children cannot in the face of, you know, these difficult circumstances? It's an interesting, fascinating question. But you know what I was really thinking about, Karen, when I asked you that, you know, you saw the news about Sue Grafton in a possible television adaptation of her books. I'm not even going to go into how I feel about that. But Sue purposely kept Kinsey before the digital age. You know, she 1989, I think, is the year that that Y ends in. So I guess one question would be, what kind of TV will it be? Will it be historical? Or, you know, or somehow Kinsey magically going to learn social media and all the rest of it? But it's a different kind of a book. It's a PI novel that you really can't write today if you want to write about contemporary society. So Karen, when you're thinking about one of your amazing books, you have to take all this into consideration, don't you?
Well, yeah, but you know, we all know what a clusterfuck technology is also. So, you know, we've all looked up, we've had a bump on our butt or whatever, and we've gone to Dr. Google and diagnosed ourselves with like stage 4 melanoma. And the doctor's like, no, that's a pimple. You know, so I think PIs still, you know, they can't rely on technology the way we think they can, right? They got to talk to people, and people lie all the time, and people lie about themselves online. So it's a lot of, you know, digging deeper, talking to people, going to places. You know, DNA in the state of Georgia takes anywhere from, unless there's a massive rush, 30 to 40 days to come back. Most rape cases are not solved with DNA because, you know, we don't really test them. Most states don't test them the way they should, which is ridiculous, because if a man rapes once, he's going to rape again and again and again until he's caught in general. But I think that you can augment stuff with technology and not have technology be the solution. And that's what I try to do. And Lisa, you know, I thought you did a really good job of keeping that balance there, of like being aware that technology is there, but also that it can fail you in a lot of ways. Cause this guy, Adam, he just completely lied. So if he's lied about everything, how do you track it down?
And in the book, it basically fails completely. And so it's really when an older character, Jones Cooper, when he steps in, he's from my fictional town, the Hollows. He is a completely analog guy. You know, he's like, you know, has a flip phone, you know, barely is on his computer. And it's really his help that, you know, when technology fails, it's the legwork, it's the talking, it's the sifting through paper, it's to going to the place where you find the answers. It's like in the real world, in the physical world. And I don't think that changes. And I think that that's true of technology in general. You know, like, we're always going to find a way to connect with each other, and because that's human nature, right? And technology is either going to augment that or inhibit it. But the truth is that a lot of us have that nostalgia for the analog world of Kinsey, you know, like when your phone was a phone and your radio was a radio and your television was a television, and they were all tools that sat around waiting to be used, and they weren't like constantly pinging and, you know, and vibrating and trying to get your attention all the time and suck you into a vortex. And so I think there, a lot of us have that nostalgia for those analog moments. And that's, you know, I think that if they could preserve that for the Grafton series, then I think people would turn to it just for that, like, sort of nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it would be historical. I mean, I guess in a sense, which is hard. Well,
I hope so. I mean, 89 was awesome.
Yeah.
Really. Well, by the time she wrote Why, it was historical. It had become that. Let me call Pat up because I'm assuming that he's back with us. Pat, are you back with us? I love this technology where he reappears from the dark. Or not.
Or not.
Damn it, Pat.
Maybe he got stuck with a customer.
I got something, Barbara.
What's that?
And I want your input on this too. So a lot of people, like in reviews now, are putting trigger warnings. And Lisa, I looked at some of your reviews. All of them are fantastic, of course, except for that one stupid person. Your cousin is really mean. But so, like, somebody put a trigger warning on it about your book, and one of the triggers was murder.
Well, you know, like, I have to own it. I'm sorry to say that, yes.
And guilt.
Okay, I'm sorry, Karen, you're gonna have to tell me what a trigger warning is if I'm to come there, because I don't even know.
I mean, it's just, I guess in a way, I kind of appreciate it because, mm-hmm. you know, if there's a sensitivity to people who have experienced trauma.
Right, it would trigger them if they read something about rape or violence violence, so it's called, like, a trigger warning.
Ratings
right.
in movies or something when they
sort
say,
of, explicit yeah, but they can be really big spoilers too. So I think it's great for people to have trigger warnings, I wish that there was an option for you to, like, click and say, I want to see the trigger warning or I don't.
Yeah.
Because if you read it, you're like, oh, this is the entire book, you know, or there's a twist or something. And you should be able to, like, not read that if you don't want to, if you're triggered by ruining the plot, that should be an option too.
Well, I think you know? If you're about reading the plot, you're ruining the plot. You probably aren't reading that much of the reviews anyway, right? Like, you, right?
Maybe.
I don't know.
But I don't know. I think it's good to have, though.
I understand it. Like,
how are you finding these?
I'm not sure. I've heard of them.
Karen, where are the trigger,
trigger warnings? Well, that's just in the vernacular. Yeah. Like on Goodreads.
Where would you find them? Are you looking at Amazon reviews?
In reviews, Goodreads, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And like I said, I think they're really useful, but I wish there was an option to say, I want to see it or I don't want to see it.
I don't read reviews. So, you know, I mean, I like my own review and that's as far as I go. So that's why I'm not
reading
this whole thing. Pat, are you there? Have you come? Yeah. I'm worried about him now that he's trapped downstairs with some insane customer who,
there he is.
I got trapped.
Yay.
You're the person who should actually be having this conversation. He's the most technological of our staff here because his real job is working at a hospital in major technology, and he drifts into the poison pen on the weekends.
My job is equally important.
you write books that trigger your readers, Karen.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Keep people alive, Pat. So you're part of that machinery. There's a little difference.
Yeah, no, I scare them with the. I make sure all the billing systems work appropriately. So that's.
Oh! I didn't know you were on the dark side. Nobody, I thought, like, you were saving lives, man.
No, I'm unfortunately keeping the doors open, but not the way that we'd like to keep them open. Sharon Person wants to say, since you both write mystery novels, what kind of reviews do you want to see?
Oh, I mean, I just want to see honest reviews. Like, I hope that people come to the books and, you know, enjoy the stories, you know, that they're entertained and that, you know, it makes them think for a while as well after the book is closed. I hope that people find it fast paced and intriguing and, you know, and that they really get to know my characters in a deep way. And, you know, if people want to leave their reviews online, you know, if they love it, then that's great. I love that.
I don't read my reviews, but when I do Zooms and things with friends, I'll read their reviews because I think, well, if there's something, if there's something that people really like about the book, you know, I want to call that out or, you know, and like I did one with Mark Billingham. I think that was with you, Barbara.
It was.
Where somebody gave him this glowing review, but it was only 3 stars.
Oh,
and that kind of thing makes me nuts. Or where they say the cover was ripped, 1 star. And you're like, not my fault.
You can't do that. Yeah.
You're not rating Amazon. You're rating me.
You can't do that. You can't do that. If you're going to
the driver left it on the doorstep and it got rained on, you know, 1 star. You do see that. But you know what, Karen, we had an insight. The other day we were doing a massive campaign for something and clearly one person misunderstood part of what was going on. And instead of contacting us, immediately put up, you know, a horrible review on Google or wherever it all was. And Bill, our manager said to me, you know, why did they do that? You know, why didn't they just email us? And I said, you know, thinking about it, if you're dealing with online retailers, for the most part, you never get a human being.
Yeah.
If you're shopping with Amazon and all, you're never going. And right. So I think that people have taken more and more to that sort of response, you know, putting up a negative review, going to Yelp, going to Google, whatever, because that's the only place that they could be heard.
Right.
You know, and so I've now realized that I need to start saying to people, we need, Pat, to start communicating to people, if there's a problem with your order, just email, you know, call us or email us. We are actual people that will.
Well, one of my books, the Lisa, I told you this in a panic, like the formatting was off and the last chapter was missing on the e-reader edition.
Oh, that's right.
And people were livid, which was absolutely the correct response to have. And some people, but you know, also some people who read it were like, it's just fantastic. And you think, wow, why did I work so hard on that last chapter? But you know, that kind of thing, you really do need to know, but Amazon's not looking at those reviews and, you know, or Barnes and Noble or whoever. So that fortunately some people posted on my Facebook page and we were able to get on top of it. Cause I mean, I'm not buying my own ebook as far as you know. So I'm certainly not reading it to see that kind of thing.
Right.
But I, you know, back to Sharon's question, I don't like bad reviews, but if it's honest and it's how you feel, I think you're entitled to put that up. And, you know, that's just the nature of the beast. And you have to be able to take that as a writer when you put, if you don't want any reviews other than good ones, then don't publish a book because somebody's going to hate it.
That's how it is. And then I think too, like after so many years, you know, and you've seen so many amazingly wonderful reviews from people and publications and whatever, and you've seen so many like, you know, this book sucks, Lisa Unger sucks, there's so many, and you're just like, well, they can't, you know, like it's got to be somewhere in the middle, right? So I'm just gonna like keep my focus where I can control things, and that's on the page and only on the page. And so it's like, you know, you might get your feelings hurt or you might be elated, but eventually you just have to get back to work. And that's the truth of the writing life, I think.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like being anorexic and looking for ways to throw up to read your own reviews, honestly.
Well, yeah. And it's not, definitely not something that I do.
Not good for you. No.
You know, Karen's right. I mean, if you're going to publish a book, meaning put it out in public where people can react to it, how's that really any different than going to a cocktail party and running in? You know, some people go like you, some people are really going to hate you. You know, I mean, it's the same dynamic.
Mm-hmm. That's why these politicians complaining about Facebook or whatever, it's like, are you kidding me? Do you know what they've said about me? Suck it up, man.
Woman up.
Yeah, that's right. That's just, that's the name. Don't be politicianing, right? What you get, you get feedback.
So is there another controversial question there? That was really
That's on any side. All politicians complain about it. Like people running for president love the press until they become president and then they hate them. They're like, no, they're against me.
It's like, of course they are.
Yeah, they're not your friends.
Catherine Hollum is curious. She says, is there something in particular that you both hope readers take from your most recent books?
I mean, I think sort of the heart of my book is that, you know, like, so Ren, part of Ren's trauma is that her father was a doomsday prepper. He called himself a collapsist, which is basically somebody who believes that the world has ended and humanity just hasn't figured it out yet. And that, you know, these are the end days. And she grew up with that trauma. That's part of what forms her. But she, through her journey in the book, you know, she makes a different choice than her father made. Her father wanted to take himself and the family away from this broken world and try to survive on their own. But Ren wants something different. You know, Ren believes that, you know, you don't get to leave. You don't get to walk away from the world. You have to stay and fight, you know, with the people that you love and that you care about, no matter what comes. And I feel like, you know, her final thoughts, or some of her final thoughts in the book, are that love is the way, that no matter what's going on in this world, you know, whether it's technology or, you know, just sort of this apocalyptic news feed that we're all exposed to all the time, that there's only one way to kind of get through whatever comes next, and that's to, you know, to love each other. And that's what I hope people take away from the book.
Well, you know, for me, my last book, False Witness, Lisa and I do a lot of research. We're both very interested in trauma. And I read this really fantastic line about children who are abused. Because a lot of times we'll say, well, at least it made you tough. Hmm. And they're children. They don't need to be tough. They need to be safe. And so I was really mindful of that when I was writing the book, because the problem with one of the many problems we have as a society is we make value judgments on victims, mm-hmm. like if they're deserving of our compassion or not, especially if they're young girls, you know, and forget it if they're Black or brown girls, you know, they're incredibly sexualized. Mm-hmm. And we kind of just forget how stupid teenage girls are. Mm-hmm. And they don't know what they're doing, and they're not emotionally, they're still children. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the whole Lolita of it all that we're still doing, where you take a young girl and she's been abused, and, you know, because she drank alcohol or she's had sex before or whatever, she's no longer a girl. We take that away from her. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I was thinking about when I wrote the book. And I hope it will give people some thoughts about, you know, how we view victims and the really weird way we decide who is truly a victim and who's not, because that's just re-victimizing them all over again to punish them for living their lives in a way you think they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
Sharon's curious to know if your storylines, do you take those from actual events? So is there something there that you see in the newspaper that, or on the news, and you just sort of jot it down as an idea or something to start the basis off of?
I mean, like the idea for a novel for me can come from anything. It could be a news story. It might be a line of poetry. In one case, it was a piece of junk mail. I don't generally do like sort of the rip from the headlines type of book, although, you know, certainly I am informed about things that are going on, and they, you know, I do read a lot about crime, and of course those things impact the type of stories that I tell. But I haven't ever really done a retelling of an actual crime or an actual event in any of my novels.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, I know you feel this way, Lisa. I'm really mindful that the stuff I'm writing about happens to people.
Right.
And I don't want to feel like I'm exploiting it.
Something horrible that did happen to somebody.
Yeah. But I take details. I mean, you have sunshine laws in Florida, so you can look at cases and things like that. But the problem with Florida is the shit that happens there, no one would believe it.
You could never.
No. It's just like, no one realizes Carl Hyacin is writing nonfiction.
I have a lot of friends who write about Florida and Florida crime, like nonfiction. And I'm just like, I just cannot make that up. Nobody would ever believe that. I just forget it. I got to do my own thing.
And then he punched an alligator. What?
Well, yeah. I mean, that people do fight alligators for their dogs.
Yeah.
They do. Yeah. Fair. A lot, often, more often than you would, think.
Anything else?
Oh, Florida.
Oh, Florida.
I think somebody mentioned the fact that they love Karen's Catterday posts.
Thank you.
Coming.
I love the one today. Saturday
post.
I love those are adorable. You see, they're making a little heart.
I did. I saw that one today. Yeah. I was like, aw.
Yeah.
All right. I'm inspired to go make a new puppy video. I have to keep up the canine side of this operation, but Catterday is just such a great idea. I don't think there's a way to translate that to dogs that make any sense. Right.
So Lisa and Karen, one of the nice things though is that I know we talked about kind of the negative reviews. You've got some of the nicest fans. So many people just said were engaged in talking with each other throughout the program and discussing topics that you guys were discussing. And you know, just so much love and respect for both of you, which is really nice.
Thank you. Thank you everybody for that. I know Karen feels the same way. I really do have the best readers. And it was amazing just in some of my live events this week to just reconnect with people I haven't seen in a long time. Like I have some people that come to every event online, and I have people that come to locally that come to every single local event. And it means so much. I mean, a writer is nothing without her readers. Like I couldn't do what I do without them. And that means a lot to hear that. So thank you. Thanks to everybody.
Absolutely. Indeed.
Thank you all for joining us. I'm going to remind you that we do have autographed copies of Last Girl Ghosted. Lisa's wonderful about signing them for us. Karen is also wonderful about signing her book for us. And we probably still have a few more signed, although I'm not sure. We might have actually sold all the way through False Witness. But let me just ask really quickly before we finish, Karen, what is it that you're coming out next for you?
A book. I can't tell you a lot about it. Someone dies, and then you have to figure out by the end who did it.
Okay.
So I've been talking to the U.S. Marshals a lot though. That have you ever hooked up with the U.S. Marshals, Lisa? They are freaking fascinating.
No, I don't have a marshal. I want one.
I got so many marshals. They are so interesting. They're like the Marines, you know?
Yeah,
they get very little money. There's fewer than 5,000 of them. They're all over the world.
Okay. I definitely need a friend.
They do. Yeah,
they're not air marshals. That's different.
Right. Yeah. I want a friend.
I got you.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. So next summer for you and Lisa, you've been pretty faithful about turning out a book in the fall. So let's hope for your fans that they will be able to look forward to one of those from each of you. It'll be great.
Absolutely.
And we'll either see you here or we'll do all this sort of thing again, whichever way it works. Anyway, thank you for spending some of your Saturday with us, everybody. And go and enjoy your Saturday night. Bye.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks,
everybody. Bye. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.